Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. One of the most insidious threats to America is what's known as political warfare. We're going to examine in the course of this show various ways in which such subversive warfare is being waged against us by both foreign adversaries and enemies within. The toll it is taking and what we can and must do about it. Very pleased to say our first guest is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. He's a career naval intelligence officer who finished up his distinguished nearly 30 years of service in uniform as the Chief of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He is one of our country's preeminent experts on the Chinese Communist Party, its military, and the unrestricted warfare, including the political kind, they have long waged against America. Captain Fennell, it's so good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Frank. I'm glad to be with you.
Your last duty station, of course, was in Hawaii. You spent most of your career, I think, not only studying, but operating in the waters of the Western Pacific. I wanted to ask you about something I spoke about with another of our duty experts, Cleo Pascal, last week. Very troubling, mostly unremarked development, part of the Chinese communists' political warfare, I think it's fair to say, but also of a very strategic kind. Talk about the Solomon Islands, sir, and what has been happening there of late, and what, as you see it, it portends.
Well, Frank, this last week, the government of the Solomon Islands and the People's Republic of China essentially inked a deal, a security agreement, a bilateral security cooperation agreement, which will include the Solomons requesting and allowing the People's Liberation Army, Navy, and other forces like air forces to be able to stop over and make use of facilities in the Solomons. And from a naval perspective, the Solomons has deep water ports or the capacity to build deep water ports. And this would allow the PLA Navy to get a foothold in a base that they have been unable to achieve so far in the South Pacific. And this is really a continuation of what has been going on for almost a decade when Xi Jinping started the Belt and Road Initiative. He said, we're going to expand our presence around the globe economically. And then in 2017, he announced three blue economic corridors, one corridor through the South China Sea into the Indian Ocean, which we're all pretty much aware of, one through the Arctic, and then one through the South Pacific, which got virtually no attention. And over the last 5 years now, they've been dutifully working to achieve that. In 2019, they were able to get the Solomon Islands and the nation of Kiribati to switch their recognition from Taiwan to the PRC. And because of the COVID, I believe, they were delayed, I think, in moving even faster because of the travel restrictions that Australia and New Zealand had put over that region. But they are now signed an agreement, or they've initialed the agreement, which allows the PRC to be able to start operating from these areas. And we saw last month PLA Navy operating in Tonga, where the United States Navy sent just a destroyer. The Chinese sent one large amphibious warship and one large resupply ship to bring relief supplies to Tonga after the big volcano that erupted there a month or so ago. And Australia also sent up an amphibious ship, but it was, had some serious material readiness problems. So China is now starting to really demonstrate through its presence of its military, showing the PRC flag in the South Pacific. And the reason this is important for Americans is because our ability to trade and work with Australia and New Zealand now will be separated essentially or cut off by the PRC moving into the South Pacific Islands, much like the Japanese did 80 plus years ago. And we fought there, you know, we say Solomon Islands, but people would know the name maybe Guadalcanal and Iron Bottom Sound and Tulagi. And so lots of American blood was shed there 80 years ago to keep these islands free. And through inattention from Canberra, Washington, and the region, China has been quietly, successfully negotiating and bribing officials there to make a presence. And we need to do something about it. And I think it's finally starting to be a wake-up call in Australia, but it's going to take some pretty serious action that if it had been taken 2 years ago or 5 years ago, we wouldn't be in that position.
Yeah, undoing damage done is always harder than preventing the damage from taking place in the first instance. Captain, you mentioned one of the places that the Chinese have also been operating is in the South China Sea. Talk, if you would, about the latest developments with respect to these, well, bastions that they have created to essentially dominate some of the most strategically significant waters and underwater resources and airspace on the planet.
Right, Frank. It got a lot of attention recently, the South China Sea, because Admiral Aquilino, the commander of the Indo-Pacific Command, was down heading to Singapore, and he did a P-8 reconnaissance flight over these islands that China has built over the last 10 years in the southern South China Sea and the Spratly Islands. They built seven islands from 2013 to 2015. And Admiral Aquilino made the announcement that he believed that these islands had been fully militarized by the PLA, meaning that they had surface-to-air missiles that could shoot down any opposing air forces, had surface-to-surface missiles that could shoot and sink any foreign navies that would be operating in that portion of the South China Sea, and also had intelligence and collection capabilities, and three 10,000-foot runways located at Fiery Cross, Subi, and Mischief Reefs. So Admiral Aquilino's statement that the islands had been militarized was kind of brought up the memory of President Xi Jinping or General Secretary Xi telling President Obama in the White House that we will never militarize those islands. And now here we are 5-6 years later, and we're acknowledging that they've been militarized. And what it really means in practical terms is China's built up their island outpost at Woody Island, which is south of Hainan, which gives them a coverage of the northern entrance to the South China Sea. And now they have these three major naval air stations and naval bases in the southern portion of the South China Sea. And in effect, they control militarily the ability of navies to operate in the South China Sea. They went from being 10 years ago, maybe one or two frigates or destroyers operating at any given time, to now they're 10, 15, 20 PLA Navy vessels operating continuously. And as you mentioned the word bastion, this is a location for their ballistic missile submarines to operate as well. And so having these bases gives a bit of an extra protection and place of safe harbor for their submarine force. So things have really transformed in the last decade.
They have, and you've been warning about it since very early on in that decade, and you've called this decade the decade of, of real danger, and I think you're being proven right, unfortunately, Captain. This brings me very quickly, before we have to take a short break, to Taiwan. How do these developments, sort of moving past the so-called first island chain and encircling Taiwan, translate into a greater danger there, especially against the backdrop of what we'll be talking about in the next block, what's been going on in Ukraine?
Well, this expansion into the South Pacific and the consolidation of power in the South China Sea really changed the dynamic for America to be able to defend Taiwan, because now Taiwan's entire southern and eastern flank are now becoming more and more exposed and becoming harder and harder for us to defend, not just an invasion from Taiwan's west coast, but now we have to consider PLA forces operating essentially around that island. And it complicates the challenge and it makes our logistics train and it makes our offensive capabilities that much more at risk.
Well, this is, again, a very, very long planned threat, and one that we are clearly seeing metastasize before our eyes. Captain Jim Fennell, you have been, as I say, both in uniform and since at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, raising the alarm about it and what it means, not just for, you know, our regional interests, for our vital ally relationships in the region, but for us here in the United States as well. We're going to take a quick break, Jim. When we come back, I want to talk with you a little bit more about the threat to even our country itself, Hawaii, but also on what political warfare and other acts are against us now from China, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. For several generations, the radical left has been relentlessly engaged in what cultural Marxists call a long march through the institutions. This program of political warfare has systematically penetrated and undermined virtually every pillar of our republic in order, as Barack Obama put it, to fundamentally transform the United States of America. The revolutionaries' long march is now poised to reach the last holdout, the Supreme Court. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson is the choice of Black Lives Matter's self-described Marxist leaders because she will be a champion of their subversive agenda of dividing Americans along racial lines, promoting toxic identity politics, and undermining the nuclear family. Judge Jackson's radicalism is evident in her now documented inveterate leniency towards purveyors of child rape, torture, and other forms of sexual abuse. She must not be allowed to begin fundamentally transforming the Supreme Court. This is Frank Gaffney.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting with one of our most distinguished and most admired colleagues. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, the former Chief of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Jim, we were talking before the break about the encirclement of Taiwan and Chinese ambitions perhaps now being amped up to use military force to seize it. You've been among those who've been warning about some of China's ambitions even further to the east, including our state of Hawaii. You've lived and worked there for many years. Tell us what the threat is as you see it emerging to Hawaii, Pearl Harbor, and other assets there.
Well, Frank, when I retired in 2015, I was already aware of the Chinese designs of their submarine force to operate what we call the Third Island Chain, which is out to the Pacific, out to Hawaii. And so the idea that China has designs on operating in and around Hawaii are not unseen before. They've come out and spied on the exercise Rim of the Pacific, or RIMPAC. They did it in 2012. They did it in 2014. They did it again in 2018. So they've been operating with intelligence collection ships in those waters. They have designs for their submarine force to operate out there. And then with their ballistic missile force, they have the capacity now to strike Hawaii with, you know, submerged launch ballistic missiles from their submarines, like the Jin class with the JL-2 or the upcoming JL-3. They have the capacity to launch land-based ballistic missiles and even air-launched with some of the capacity they're going to have with their new strategic stealth bomber. So the idea that they would put Hawaii at risk is something that's real and tangible, and I think it even goes beyond that. I think the Chinese have designs to operate off of our west coast, and they've said that, you know, we want to operate off your coast like you operate off of our coast. And so I think we sometimes, I think 2 years ago, we had a big surface action group of over six ships that passed the international dateline and were operating closer to Hawaii than they were to Guam. So these moves towards Hawaii.
A Chinese flotilla you're
Chinese
talking about.
Chinese Navy has been expanding out there. And so it's not gotten a lot of attention, but they've been slowly expanding, much in the same way that they did 10 years ago when they were expanding into the South China Sea and into the Philippine Sea past Okinawa.
Yeah, making promises that, as you say, they wouldn't use those forays or the products of them for military purposes. Jim, part of the reason why we have not responded more robustly to these developments is, of course, this foreign policy known as engagement. You've been sharply critical of it, and I think rightly so, for many, many years. One of the forces at work behind persistent pursuit of, a practice that effectively simply makes China richer and more powerful, somehow on the thought that it's going to become more like us or at least more benign, is a practice known as elite capture, a form of political warfare. Our friend Peter Schweitzer has written about it quite impressively in his new book, Red Handed. Talk a little bit, if you would, particularly from the point of view of an intelligence professional, as well as a deeply thoughtful strategist when it comes to contending with the Chinese Communist Party, that is, more and more evidence comes to light from, among other places, Hunter Biden's laptop. The commander-in-chief of the United States himself has been deeply compromised, or, if you would, captured by our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, Frank, this revelation, it's been going on for a couple of years, but now it seems to be accepted that this laptop is a legitimate piece of evidence, and the reports of the email exchanges between Hunter Biden and, you know, essentially being an employee of a Chinese state-owned enterprise, petroleum company, and having communications with the chief of their intelligence. This is all things that seem very, very hard to comprehend. I served for, like you said, for many, many years, and with many, many thousands and thousands of people that had clearances, and we had to get, you know, updates and polygraphs and any type of association with anybody from an adversary nation like China, or Russia, Iran, North Korea, even friendly nations. Some kinds of associations are required to be reported and analyzed, and you're judged on whether or not you would be allowed to keep your clearance. And in most cases, you would not be. People would be lose their clearances and be removed from the service, at least in any position of authority over classified information.
Especially if money was changing hands from that intelligence service to the individual who had these clearances, no?
Right, and the fact that there's, you know, this person is associated with the former vice president and now the president, it's hard to comprehend why there isn't just a massive hue and cry for, we need to investigate this. Forget what party you're from. It's really dangerous, the idea that we have people at that level that are now, for the first point, they didn't even reveal it when they came into office or when they were running, or it's hard to comprehend. Anybody else that would have had anything like this would be, in Leavenworth, breaking big rocks into little rocks.
In the brig. I was very pleased to say Mark Levin on his show on Fox News last night, effectively joined me, among others, in calling for just such an investigation. It's long overdue. And frankly, the country is in very serious peril, I believe, as a result of this compromise at the highest levels. And by the way, in a number of strata below the president as well, something that I encourage people to take a look at, accountabilityinitiative.org, for a lot more documentation on it. Jim Fennell, you mentioned that one of Xi Jinping's priorities has been a Belt and Road Initiative. This is, I think of it as a colonial empire build out from which, yes, to foster powerful economic ties and to help create infrastructure around the world. But in particular, it seems increasingly clear, from which to project power, by the Chinese Communist Party's People's Liberation Army as well. Talk a little bit about how this has come about, the political warfare and corruption, elite capture that has generated it, and very quickly, if you would, its implications.
Right. The Belt and Road, as Xi titled it back in 2013, was the One Belt, One Road. And for the last essentially 9 years, he's been expanding China's economic involvement throughout South Asia, the South China Sea, through the Indian Ocean, across Central Asia, and essentially offering up money to small countries that couldn't afford it to give them things for infrastructure, and that they would then allow the PRC to have access to their markets, access to their produce, their resources, and also access to their bases. And so we're now starting to see, you know, people like to say America's got over 700 bases around the world, even though some of those bases are pet cemeteries and things of that nature. The reality is that China is on the march to set up this network of spoke and hub, where they can send their ships, send their aircraft, and have the resources there. They can defend their interests with their military, and they can expand their power, as you said, very much like a colonial or mercantilist power, where they control the means of production, the resources, and if anybody in the local area gets out of the way, then they can come in and use their military. And we're seeing that happen. It's just spreading like a cancer across
the world. It's a very, very apt phrase for it. Captain, we have to leave it at that. This is a topic to which we will return with your help, I hope, in the very near future. Few people have as clear a vision of it as you do, and we so appreciate your sharing it with us. Come back to us again soon, sir. Next up, we're going to speak with the CEO, Rebecca Weber, of a terrific grassroots organization, the Association for Mature American Citizens, about political warfare here at home and what her outfit is doing about it. That more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined for the first time by a woman I admire greatly. Her name is Rebecca Weber. She is the chief executive officer of a terrific grassroots organization, the Association of Mature American Citizens, that are known as AMAC. It is the conservative alternative to the leftist-dominated AARP. She is also the editor-in-chief of the organization's publication, AMAC Advantage, and the host of its Better for America podcast, on which I've been privileged to appear. Full disclosure, I'm a new member of AMAC and a big fan of its work, including that of its spokesman, former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles, whom we're privileged to have as a regular contributor to this program. Rebecca Weber, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. It's a real honor to be here with you.
Thank you. We're going to talk, I hope, with you, Rebecca, about both your own thoughts on the topics at hand, but also those of your members for whom you speak very effectively. I want to talk about it in the context of political warfare and something that Ronald Reagan warned about decades ago. He talked about every generation facing an existential threat to freedom. And he warned that if we did not rise to such threats in our time, that we would wind up telling our children and our children's children what it was like to live in the United States when men were free. I know you and your organization are committed to ensuring that's not our fate, but talk a little bit, if you would, about kind of how members of AMAC view this issue, this challenge of defending our country against those who would take it down, transform it beyond recognition through political warfare and, well, other means of subversion.
Yeah, thank you so much. What a great question, Frank, because the real threat to democracy, in my view, is the left's ruthless agenda to really rule or ruin. What do I mean by that? Well, their attitude is, if you don't carry the left's vision of democracy, then, well, it's not a democracy, and it's not legitimate. And I believe that Democrats already believe that because of their failure of H.R. 1, which was one of their ways that they would rule, that is off the table. That was the federal takeover of our elections. The real question now is, what are they going to do when they're left with only the option of ruin? And I love your quote by Reagan. It reminds me of another famous quote, liberty once lost is lost forever. When the people once surrender their share in the legislature and their right of defending the limitations upon the government and of resisting every encroachment upon them, they can never regain it. And those were words written by John Adams. And so that is really, those words, I think, ring true today. And AMAC members are recognizing that today our nation is facing unprecedented challenges. Frank, we're seeing everything from election integrity, conservative censorship, vaccines, mandates, passports, mask mandates for young children, surging crime levels across the country and a border that's not secure. I think that the massive overspending by the Biden administration has fueled runaway inflation. We see skyrocketing gas prices. And so AMAC members see it, Frank. They're saying when Trump left office, America was energy independent. But Biden, really on his very first day in office, he signed an executive order revoking the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. And so now that Biden is looking to other countries like Venezuela for oil, AMAC members are saying, wait a minute, what about us, we the people? We've got to be focusing on protecting our great liberties and the values that make this country great. And that's exactly what we're doing here at AMAC. But there's a lot of work ahead of us.
Well, I want to talk to you about that work. But first, just to drill down on a couple of those really important points of the sort of context in which we're having this conversation. I agree with everything you said, and I'm sure your members do as well, Rebecca, with the possible exception of it seems to me as though the Biden administration is kind of going for rule and ruin in the damage that they're doing to our country, even as they profess to govern it, is almost incalculable in all of those areas. And I would add one other item to the list, and I know you, it was meant to be illustrative, but it was pretty comprehensive. But one that you didn't mention is the Marxist strategy of dividing and conquering. And it takes the form, particularly these days, as you know, of what's been called critical race theory, that we're seeing our children indoctrinated with, the military is being subjected to, and our country more generally. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, and how AMAC members who are concerned not only about, you know, what's happening in our present generation, but what it means for the next. We're saying about that.
Yeah, that is so important. And we actually poll our members. We poll our members. We take our marching orders from our over 2.4 million members. And I said to them, I said to my team, let's ask them how they feel on critical race theory. And so the team put together a really comprehensive poll. And we learned that AMAC members, mainly anybody can join AMAC, but most are 50 and older, said, help to stop the indoctrination of our children in our school systems, because they truly recognize that they are the future of our nation. And they're the ones who will be left to carry the torch. What I find interesting about critical race theory, Frank, is the left's refusal to acknowledge that it even exists. And when you are working in a country alongside people who refuse to see your side, and if you don't, essentially they just cancel you, that's a way to not get any work done. And so AMAC members are saying, what can we do? And so we're encouraging people to participate. When you see something, say something. Make sure you're talking and engaged with your children. I think that the pandemic has largely helped parents see through a lot of what their kids were being taught in school. But I also think parents and grandparents are stepping up, and they're volunteering for their school board. They're showing up at meetings and they're speaking out. We want to make sure that we're not going along with these big institutions that are demanding we do things their way. Or again, they say, we'll cancel you, we'll destroy what you thought this looked like, beyond our recognition almost. And so we're seeing that with critical race theory. We're seeing how youth are being taught things like there's more than one gender. You can be a boy, a girl, or any of the other multitude of genders. And we know that that goes against science. And we also see that it's just so unhealthy because, you know, Frank, as a mother and a grandmother, I like to remind my children every day that they are wonderfully made by an all-powerful God who gives each and every one of us beautiful strengths, and our diversity is what really makes us such a wonderful nation, that we're all so different, and we bring different gifts to the table. And so we're going backwards when we try to get our children to embrace this dangerous way of thinking that we should judge people based on how they look, not on the merit of their character.
The color of their skin, as it were, going back to Martin Luther King. I'm so glad you mentioned institutions. In my commentary today, Rebecca, I talk about the long march through the institutions that has been underway at the hands of the left now for decades. Cultural Marxism, I think, is really what it amounts to. An institution that they're at the cusp of penetrating is perhaps the last that has felt their direct effect, namely the Supreme Court. And I just wonder what your members are thinking about, if you've polled them, or what you assess they are thinking about. This Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, and in particular, a piece that again goes to the heart of what you were just saying about our children. Her practice, it seems, a sort of inveterate leniency that she has felt towards those who are engaged in, or at least purveying, pornography about child rape and torture and other forms of sexual abuse. It's unimaginable to me that such a person would be on the Supreme Court of the United States. What do your members think?
Well, you know, our members are smart. They've got a lot of real good common sense. And so let's start when Senator Marsha Blackburn first said, could you provide a definition for the word woman? And when Jackson responded, no, I can't, I'm not a biologist, that's a red flag right there. And moreover, I think Senator Ted Cruz, he revealed since 2019 that she served on a school board of trustees in Georgetown Day School. Now, what's really interesting about this, Jackson, I believe she expressed that she was unaware of some of the materials that were being shared, but she did say that she witnessed a transformative power of rigorous progressive education that's dedicated to fostering critical thinking, independence, social change, and social justice. What I'd like to say to that is that let's look at what the types of books that Georgetown Day School assigns. And this was all uncovered, that they are assigning the Ibram Kendi How to Be an Anti-Racist and other books that support critical race theory. So our concern is it far-fetched for us to think that Jackson may see herself as someone who, you know, embraces critical race theory. We know she gave a speech. Now, this was in January of 2020. She gave a speech praising Derrick Bell. Now, Derrick Bell is widely considered to be the father of CRT, critical race theory. So for these reasons, Frank, our members feel that she probably is fitting Joe Biden's description of the person he wanted to find, a black female. But isn't it interesting that female or woman was one of the checkboxes on Biden's list, yet Jackson herself could not define to us what a female is?
We have to leave it at that, Rebecca, I'm sorry to say. And it goes on from there. We'll talk a bit more about it with our next guest, George Raceley, as a matter of fact. But I so appreciate both your leadership at AMAC, what you're doing with your podcast, and your visits with us. I hope there'll be many of them to come in the near future. In the meantime, keep up the great work at the Association for Mature American Citizens. Next up, George Raceley. We'll talk with him, a very accomplished political campaigner, about political warfare, what it means for you.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're continuing our conversation about the practice of political warfare here at home. And I couldn't be more pleased to be talking with a man who has demonstrated his proficiency in the Democratic version of that. That is, small d, Democratic version. His name is George Raceley. He is a highly accomplished political campaigner, having served on some 300 of them over the years at all levels of government. He was, among other things, a senior advisor to the Vice President of the United States, and these days is the managing editor of Richard Viguerie's Conservative HQ. He's one of the smartest guys I know, and always delighted to have him here on Hearing America. George, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Frank. I have the wounds to show for those 300 campaigns I've been involved in. So
you do. Bloodied but unbowed, as they say. George, let me ask you about something I talked about briefly earlier with Rebecca Weber of AMAC, namely the march through the institutions that enemies within, cultural Marxists, I guess is the term that's usually applied to them, have been engaged in, and whether we're at the brink of their success in penetrating arguably the last of our institutions, and certainly one of the most important, namely the Supreme Court, with the impending, expected, confirmation of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Your thoughts both on that thesis and this particular nominee?
Well, I think that thesis is 100% correct, and that Judge Brown Jackson is the epitome of its success. She has been a cultural Marxist, which is a good term to describe him, since she was in college. Her record is replete with evidence of that. And it is particularly concerning because she has kind of said the quiet part out loud that one of their prime goals is not just excusing, but normalizing pedophilia and the sexual abuse of children, the sexualization of children at a very young age. And so this is really a new front in that war. Normally, we think of Marxism as being a economic argument primarily, or one about the role of the state and property and what have you. But this is an entirely new front in that war.
It is indeed. And another manifestation of it, and I don't know that she has applied this term to the various felons she has given very lenient treatment to in sentencing whenever she's been able to do so, I think on 8 occasions. The so-called minor attracted persons is a classic sort of leftist euphemism to normalize, as you say, some of the most odious and dangerous of criminals. And to put a fine point on it, as you know, what we're talking about are people who either engage themselves or simply purvey to untold numbers of others, child rape and torture and other forms of horrific abuse. Richard, it's really unspeakable that this would be something that a Supreme Court justice would countenance, let alone excuse. And to what extent, connect the dots for me, if you would, to what extent does that evidence a more broad radicalism, if not, you know, full-on cultural Marxist character?
Well, the one of the essential features of cultural Marxism is normalizing the abnormal and tearing down what, you know, the norms of Western civilization and replacing them with a new civilization based on these Marxist principles. You know, this goes back to Leninism and the establishment of the Soviet Union, where one of their goals was to create a new man, the new Soviet man, the new Soviet woman. Well, the new American man or woman in the eyes of the cultural Marxists will accept all these perverse sexual practices that have been prohibited by Western civilization for 2,000 years. They will countenance the trafficking of children. They will do or accept among their neighbors practices that we just, you know, we can barely talk about on TV. And the whole idea is to destroy the mores of Western civilization, the things that have made us unique, the things that have created the social structures that lead to the quality of life and the fabulous civilization that is, that was America.
Yeah. You haven't used the term, but I know it's implicit in what you've said about Western civilization and American values and qualities, George Raceley. Is the moral and theological underpinnings of our country, of our republic, and the destruction of those is very much of a piece with this larger design of enemies of this country, cultural Marxists and other leftists who seek to take it down and, as you say, replace it with something far worse. George, we're going to have to take a short break here in just a moment, but when we come back, I want to visit with you about what this prospective elevation of such a radical to the Supreme Court is likely to mean for the court itself, for the other 8 members of it today, for the kinds of people who may be appointed to it in the future, for that matter. And to what extent, particularly, does the fact that Black Lives Matter, as the organizational leadership, at least, has endorsed and helped ensure the selection of this particular Black female when the president insisted that that's the only kind of person he was going to consider. We'll talk about that and more with the great George Raceley right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are visiting with George Raceley, an astute observer of the political scene, but also a very skilled practitioner of Democratic politics, small d again, and the degree to which it's changing before our very eyes under a very significant, sustained, disciplined, and dangerous assault from enemies within. And Richard, you were very, I think, direct about concerns that you have about Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson and her nomination to be the next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. I wonder whether you share my concern that it's not just that there would be a ninth individual who would have extreme views and that those extreme views would translate into perhaps bad votes or bad decisions or at least, you know, bad rulings on her part, but that she may exercise a disproportionate influence on the rest of the court, if not at this very moment. I mean, we're told that she's just replacing another left-of-center judge, Justice Breyer, but certainly in the future. And that that's what makes this different from just a one-for-one switch out of people basically sharing the same ideology.
Yeah, absolutely, Frank. And what this does really is kind of move the Overton window, if you will, as to what are acceptable views of the law and its moral underpinnings way, way, way far to the left. Someone with these views couldn't have been appointed a, you know, a U.S. attorney 10 years ago, let alone a circuit court or appeals court judge or a judge to the Supreme Court, Justice of the Supreme Court. And so what this, again, you know, we've talked about normalizing things. Well, what this does is it normalizes her views. Those views now have a seat at the table on the Supreme Court. And even if she loses every argument, she will write a dissent, which will be quoted in lower courts, and that Overton window will keep moving left that interpretation of the law and its oral moral underpinnings will keep moving to the left. So this was a very intentional choice on the part of, you know, whoever is the puppet master at the White House these days.
I have to ask you about that, George, because I think it's on a lot of people's mind at the moment. We're watching Joe Biden with all of his deficiencies, and they are numerous. Poor judgment, for sure. Increasing senescence, if not senility. But the question still has to be asked, who is the president of the United States at the moment, if not by title, by fact? Who is making the decisions about, well, picking this Supreme Court nominee at the guidance or certainly with the strong support of the hard left, including BLM? And more broadly, who's making decisions about Ukraine? Who was responsible for the Afghan debacle? Who is essentially ensuring that our border is left open so that untold millions of people, especially a group that's now going to come in under the absence of the COVID-related Title 42 provision. Who's in charge, as best you can tell, George Wilson?
Well, the scariest answer I could give you, Frank, is Joe Biden. but certainly his chief of staff, Ron Klain, senior advisor Susan Rice, have disproportionate influence over these matters. And it's undoubtedly true that they listen to a couple of very, very radically left members of Congress.
How about a former president of the United States by the name of Barack Obama, for whom they all worked?
Absolutely. And so, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, basically say that Obama is simply channeled into the White House for every important decision. I don't know if that's true.
I told you he actually has an office in the White House. I don't know if that's true or not, but it at least functionally, he seems to be playing a disproportionate role.
Actually, I think if Obama was running things, it would at least go smoother. It might not go any further to the right or to the center, but it would at least go more smoothly.
Well, this goes back to something I talked about earlier with Rebecca Weber, George, and that is, what if it's actually by design that things are not going terribly smoothly, or at least not well? What if it is, in fact, the purpose of, well, cultural Marxists, Marxists of other stripes, whatever you want to characterize them as, the radical left, that really it's a wrecking operation. The worse, the better, as the communists have been known to say, to make it so bad that people will succumb to their ideas of fundamentally transforming our country.
Well, if you want to create the new man or the new civilization, you have to tear down the old one. And there was a brief respite when the wrecking ball was not swinging quite so hard for the 4 years that Trump was in office. And now they're back full tilt.
And determined to finish the job, I fear. And the fact that we don't know exactly who's running the place is a further both indictment and real problem, obviously. George, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but we're going to have you back further to talk about what we better do about all of this, because this is obviously a perilous, perilous state of affairs. I want to say a word of thanks to our hosts. I'm in Dallas, and I want to say particularly Kevin Freeman, Russell Lake, and the team at Economic War Room. Heartfelt thanks for enabling us to take the show on the road. And I want to thank all of you for participating in this edition of Securing America. It, I hope, has left you better equipped to help us do that. For more on what you can do, check out securingamerica.tv. Follow me on Getter and Twitter at Frank Gaffney, and then go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.